All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's training. As we approach the top of the hour, I'm going to cover some housekeeping rules for today's training. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Clouin for those not able to join us live. Please use the question and answer box, or also known as the Q&A box, at the bottom of your Zoom webinar to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems at any time today. We will have a question and answer break. We'll be responding to questions at the end of the training here, as this is an expert panel. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the feedback form, you will click a box to certify that you participated, and a certificate will be provided to you. The feedback form will be available upon the end of the training today. So with that, on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC Environmental Data Management Roundtable. My name is Devin Setchkar. I'm your moderator today from Washington, D.C. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online resources on environmental data management produced by ITRC in 2022. Today's roundtable is focusing on data exchange. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Clouin. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed with members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams and produce tools and resources and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website to learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide four, I have the pleasure of introducing our trainers today. All of them serve as members of ITRC's environmental data management team and have volunteered to support the training offered here today. I'm going to pass it off now to Olga Stewart from GeoSynTech to moderate this roundtable discussion.
Thank you, Devin, and thanks everyone for joining today. We hope to have an engaging discussion with lots of questions coming from you all and with our panel of five experts that we're acting as a roundtable to answer your questions. I have the honor of moderating today's discussion with these five experts, and you can read their full bios on the Clouin page where you registered. All of us were involved in developing the ITRC electronic data management guidance, like Devin said, which we shortened to EDM. This roundtable is one of three that are meant to be training for the guidance, and they're part of the overall training catalog, which also includes a 10-minute overview video of the whole guidance itself, and then also a discussion of traditional ecological knowledge. So there was one roundtable that already occurred on data management planning and field data collection, which you can access in the archives for Clouin. And there is another one that's upcoming on May 2nd for data quality that you might want to register for. So over the last 2 years, this EDM team has been working on preparing the guidance, which is now available on the ITRC website. And I can see that in the question and answer pod, we've got a link to that guidance if you want to pull it up and have it ready and referenceable while we're talking through it today. I encourage you all to bookmark that, explore through the material. It's divided into topics and various fact sheets on individual topics. So what we're going to discuss today is based on that guidance, and we'll refer to those fact sheets frequently. The scope, as you can imagine, of environmental data management is really quite broad, ranging from data planning and collection to governance and data accessibility. But today, our discussion is focused on exchange. We'll, of course, touch on the other topics as they affect data exchange, but hopefully what you're here to learn about and talk about is exchanging data. So we want to hear your questions. If you haven't already, please do familiarize yourself with the Q&A pod and type in any questions that you have for our panelists as we start the discussion. We'll go ahead and get started with a few frequently asked questions to kind of get the juices flowing for you. And then we'll get into your questions as we see them come through and try and answer them as we see them. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get started. So just to kind of familiarize ourselves a little on the language that we need to be able to communicate effectively about the subject, let's just dive into what in the world do we mean by data exchange? And we'll start with Evan.
Thanks, Olga. So data exchange is the process of sharing data generally between environmental data management systems, also known as EDMSs. And we have a whole fact sheet also about EDMSs if you want more information about what that means. And generally, it's about making data accessible. Normally, data exchanges are planned in advance, and they can reoccur with some regular frequency. We usually think of them in terms of both incoming data and outgoing data. So for example, an analytical laboratory might send you data after every sampling event, and you might then take that data and eventually send it on to a regulator or somebody else. Data in your database that follow specific rules, data in your EDMS that follow specific rules are known as valid values. And we have a whole fact sheet all about valid values. So for example, maybe all the dates that you have in your data are in a very specific format of year, month, and day, for example. And a different EDMS might use a different valid value format, such as month, day, year. So one common challenge of data exchange is translating your data from one set of valid values to another and making sure that translation happens correctly.
And one thing you can really keep in mind when you're working with these valid values is the fact that your valid values don't have to be generated from scratch. One thing that is kind of a best management practice that we discuss in the fact sheet is adopting accepted valid values from authoritative resources if possible, not reinventing the wheel, so to speak, on this. Authoritative resources to check for the existing valid values include non-EDMS sources. So things like the EPA Substance Registry Services for names and the Chemical Abstract Service registry numbers for CASRNs, we'll call them periodically throughout this discussion, to identify the specific chemicals or go into public reference tables from established EDMSs. If you are submitting data to a regulated agency, such as the one I work for, checking out and seeing what their valid values are may save you some trouble down the line. The resource list in our guidance document has a number of other examples for this. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, which is the agency I work for, recently reviewed valid values from a number of different other EDMSs and other authoritative sources when developing the Minnesota Groundwater Contamination Atlas, which is documented in the Historical Data Migration Case Study. You can go check that out if you want to find out some more details about what we did and how we navigated this particularly challenging event.
So one of the things that you need to consider when you're using valid values developed by other organizations is that there could be omissions or inadvertent errors, or the definitions may have changed over time. One thing to keep in mind, which actually happened just this morning in a conversation I was having, was two agencies were sharing valid values and they noticed a discrepancy between the number of, in this case, it was a group of analytes that were matching up to a broad group of chemicals. And so there was some discussion about how to exchange it, make sure that those were accurate and correct so that the data exchange process would be as seamless as possible. So it's always good to check often and verify that the version, the values that you want to have are the right ones.
A few other key points before we really dive into the weeds on this. One is that, you know, when you're receiving data from a data provider, such as your laboratory analytical data or data coming in from the field, it usually comes in the form of an electronic data deliverable or EDD. There is also a lovely fact sheet on, you know, more information on this. And basically, it's a structured data file that will place the data you're receiving in a particular column order, so that hopefully it'll be a smooth process to get that data back from your lab field and pop it into your electronic data management system. It is important to note that you should definitely QC this, both for the structure and continuing on the topic of valid values, to make sure any values in your EDD are consistent with your database. For instance, you know, if you have a well and it's MW1 and in your database it's MW-01, make sure the EDD doesn't say MW-1. Similarly, if you have any analytes that kind of have fuzzier CAS numbers, that might be harder to get from an authoritative resource, no matter how hard you try, make sure that whatever's coming from the lab is consistent with whatever you selected for that value. Another important point on data exchange is that if you're receiving data from a legacy database, you might not have a nice smooth workflow the way that you can develop with, you know, field personnel or your laboratory. In that case, it's data migration, for which there's, you know, another detailed fact sheet, which is a subset. And the primary difference is that it's usually more of a one-time event, and you might have to kind of go through and figure out how you're going to map that data source into your current EDMS.
And generally speaking, there's another set of terminology that you probably should be familiar with, and that is extract, transform, and load, or ETL, which is a more general description of basically getting data into your system from some other system. In many cases, the sort of ETL process involves one party. It's you pulling data into your system. Data migration is typically a process that involves two people or two organizations, that is a submitter or provider and the recipient. So the data exchange process sometimes involves some negotiation, interaction, back and forth between the two parties.
So yeah, I think that was a great intro to some of the language that we use, right? So valid values is a critical point. Electronic data deliverables or EDVs is a critical point. Extract, transform, load, or ETL is another critical point. And so also I noticed in the Q&A pod, there was a question that came in that felt like, oh my gosh, we just really dove right in. And this felt kind of like the end. But it is really important to get us all on the same page and using this vocabulary, because having the same communication and vocabulary around this will really make it possible for us to be able to talk about this, because it's such a niche set of terms that we use to talk about all this exchanging. So hopefully we don't lose you, and starting out with these few terms kind of gets us all in the same frame to keep working. And so I do encourage you to keep putting those questions in the Q&A pod, and we'll keep answering them as we go. So I know we've already brought up a little bit about this analytical laboratory concept, and I'm sure a lot of people on this call deal with that concept of getting in analytical laboratory data and how to handle that. So can we talk about how do you handle receiving data from an analytical laboratory? And we'll start with Dan.
Thanks, Olga. So the best way really to handle receiving data from the analytical laboratory is making sure that you provide that laboratory or laboratories with specification that you need for your EDMS. So it's everything from the structure of the EDD format, like Tori mentioned in the previous question, and the list of valid values that are appropriate. And I noticed that we had a question that in the pod about matching fields between EDDs and existing database. Well, this speaks to that very topic, is when you have that specification, you can indicate whether, for example, with locations, you want to use leading zeros, or you want to use specifications for anywhere we have a monitoring well, you want to use the prefix MW, for example. And as long as that specification is comprehensive, or as comprehensive as you can get it, then you can take advantage of that, and that should give you the opportunity to have as seamless data exchange as possible.
Another important tool to making that exchange as seamless as possible is that once you've communicated everything to the lab, as Dan mentioned, you do want to make sure you have some type of internal tool tracking sheet to document any changes you might need to make to the EDD as it comes in. As we've mentioned before, it is always important to, you know, QC it once you receive it, because there's always the chance that, you know, maybe something was just a little bit different in your most recent sampling round and the lab might not exactly have handling that for your needs down to a science, or maybe, you know, something just went wonky in their system and the EDD came out a bit weird this time. So definitely always review it carefully and document any changes that need to be made before import, either in comparing the valid values to your database. Another tool for that can be that a lot of database systems do have some type of EDD checker built into the system where you can kind of review, oh, does this, you know, location name in my EDD match location names in my data management system. And then once you have all the documentation, you can always, the ideal situation is to go back to the lab and just communicate it so that next time they can give you the perfect EDD. But if for some reason that's just not possible, it also allows you to make sure that every time you receive the EDD, nothing's falling through the cracks.
Yeah, and similar to what Dan mentioned about your look of values and your established values, those sorts of things, the question in the Q&A brought up the potential for using lookup tables. And that's a great idea. A lookup table or a translation table can be something that you can use to convert, you know, quote unquote, foreign valid values to those valid values that are used in your EDMS before the incoming data received, which makes sure that you are working on the efficiency and the reproducibility of your data import process on it. That works in the opposite direction too, because you can also export it before going out to a different EDMS. If you have a case where you call something one thing, but a lab calls it another, having those translation tables, which can be based off your valid reference values, is really helpful. The notorious MW1 sticks in my mind here, because as I mentioned in the case study that we have about historical data migrations, this was something that we dealt with at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on a lot as part of that process. Our sites have been around for years and years, and different companies come in and they always start with MW1, it seems like. So to look back to my previous answer on it, we look to an authoritative data source that existed outside of our EDMS, which in Minnesota is called the County Well Index, is a authoritative data source for unique well numbers for each monitoring well that's across the way. Fully cognizant that not every company or every state may have the benefit of having this, establishing those sort of unique constraints where MW1, it doesn't become an issue because you as a company, as a state agency, as a government agency, as a federal agency, have something that can be there to help you see what's going on and make sure that your valid values are unique each and every time. That being said, it's also important to QC and QA these things as you go through to take a look at them. Regardless of how great all of your valid values, how great your data translation tables may be, if it's something that's not done on a consistent basis, they may be missing. You can't always trust the systems to do this translation and this QC for you, or that your automated format or automated solution may not be working as designed, which could be, and we had another question in chat as well about difficulties with lab matching valid values to what was provided in RFVs. That QAQC, I'll let others speak a little bit more thoroughly on that, but checking that, being able to find that you are providing a valid reference value and everything is good on your end and there's labs on the other end that are either not following it. That's a conversation, that's a follow-up, those sorts of things, but I will let others speak a little bit more on that one.
Well, I think one of the things that Michael brings up as a valid point is, how do you deal with, maybe it's smaller laboratories or boutique laboratories that handle very specific analyses. And again, they may not have the IT infrastructure to generate EDDs from their LIM systems. So there's two steps there. One is you could consider, again, using the guidance that are provided in the fact sheets, you can develop a simple EDD format, or it, depending upon the nature of the analytes being provided, or it's bioassay or what have you, specifying the valid values and having a mechanism to enter the data easily. But you still have to do it. It goes back to the original thing that I pointed out, which is you have a specification and you document the specification. If you're going to use that lab routinely, it's going to make a big difference. And then again, regarding the difficulties, like Michael said, I hate to say it, it's the power of the purse strings. If they can't provide the data to you in a usable format, then look at other options, if possible. And again, you want to try to avoid wherever possible the manual editing. So
I'll jump in and add on to say that if you do find that you must use a certain laboratory and you need to do something manually over and over, you could set up your own automated process to correct that, assuming that all of the specifications stay the same way. And we'll talk a little bit more later on about automation, how you can use that to help your data management.
Yeah, so hopefully we've answered that question about, difficulties with the laboratories and trying to get things matched up. But I think that we do have this concept of what do we do with data, receiving data from somebody that they're not providing it in a real format that we can use. I mean, maybe it's not tabular or it's in some kind of format that just really is hard for us to deal with. Evan?
Yeah, so it's the classic PDF. You get all your data from the lab as a PDF. Thanks. Yet not all EDD formats are easy to work with, and they might be unstructured, and a PDF certainly qualifies as unstructured as well as many other things. And what we mean by unstructured is that it doesn't have an explicit schema or follow implicit simple patterns that you can use to take the data out and structure it. And depending on the EDMS schema and the planned use of the data, you're probably going to need to add at least some of the structure to the data yourself in order to get it into your EDMS. Now, so for example, maybe you have a collection of field notes that were handwritten. You might need to translate the information on those pages into cells in the spreadsheet, adding structure to it. And this is a form of data migration.
I mean, can I ask you to define schema? I feel like that's another word that we're using that we haven't really well defined for everyone on the phone.
Yeah, so a schema is the structure, the format, the layout. So for example, in a spreadsheet, it might be the columns and the rows that are in it. If you have maybe a different format, like a JSON format, like a general object or an XML file, if you've heard of those also have a specific structure that they follow that should be a pattern that your computer can read and figure out what kind of data are in there.
Thanks. Sorry, Dreas, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I just wanted to add, with regard to importing data from intractable formats like PDFs, sometimes that's going to require a large effort and a large budget, sometimes more than you really can or want to afford. So one of the things that you should consider doing is prioritizing the data to be pulled in from such formats, possibly limiting the amount or types of data that you pull in. For example, limiting the number of samples, limiting the number of analytes for which data are extracted from such a format. And when doing that, you should keep in mind the data quality objectives or DQOs for your project to make sure that you are getting the data that are most important to you and maybe letting go of the stuff that's hard and not so valuable.
Yeah, and another thing to keep in mind on this is that a data exchange is often between two distinct parties. And sometimes one of those two parties may be averse to providing the data in a readily accessible format. There's a number of reasons those could be. It might be a specific strategy by one of the parties. There may be legal reasons that they are doing this. There could be some cases where they don't have the technology available. As Dan mentioned earlier, with some of the boutique laboratories, some of them may not have a functional LIMS. Some of them may be doing kind of cutting edge work with non-target analyses or other sort of environmental data collection and analysis where there's just not a great way to report it out in a standardized EDD format. Or they could be the opposite, where they're out there doing colometric samples or field measurements, and they're just reporting things on an image or an Excel file because that's all that they've collected it on. Sometimes, unfortunately, the parties don't care. There's a minimum requirement for submittal, but it doesn't say what the submittal may be. So they have checked all the boxes and are able to move on. So it is a case where even if you have everything laid out perfectly, there can be cases where the other party is just not wanting to share the data in the format that you're looking for.
I think we can probably all agree, right, that the better data exchange is where we're communicating effectively with people who care about the data and want it to be translated effectively between systems or EDMSs. I did want to note that we saw in the panel there, in the Q&A pod about MW1, we use that as kind of like a go-to thing. So monitoring well-1, typically people just go straight to using a naming nomenclature of one when they're starting out at a site, even if they may not be the first company that's put in a monitoring well at that particular site. And so over years, you may get several monitoring well ones, and then how do you distinguish between them? It's kind of a key component of establishing distinct naming and how we kind of move into the future and putting a whole data set together that can function effectively. So I do want to encourage you all to keep using that Q&A pod. We love seeing all your questions come in. We're here to answer a lot of your questions. Nothing is too small. MW1 questions are great. They really are kind of the foundational granular piece of what we're doing here. So just switching gears a little bit, we've talked a lot about that incoming data. Like Evan had talked about at the beginning, data exchange is both incoming and outgoing. So let's just talk about this idea of outgoing data. You get a request from somebody that says, give me all your data. You know, they don't say anything about what or what format or anything. What are some ways that you can handle that request? Tori?
One strategy that I found effective is to try to get more of a sense of the intended purpose of the data. You know, is it a summary table that's going in an annual report where only, maybe they only need the last year's worth of routine groundwater monitoring data? Then you can kind of isolate, okay, they need that in a summary table, and maybe work with them if there's any other data deliverables, visualizations they need. If it's, you know, something that is more comprehensive, feeding some type of, you know, 3D visualization model or groundwater model or risk assessment, then it's really important to put a caution note about the quality of the data, because especially if you have, you know, a 30, 40 plus year site, the data you're using most recently, so the data you're putting in your routine reports and kind of QCing every time you send a report out, you're going to feel more confident in that than you might in a random soil sample from 1980. And so that's definitely a, you know, an important conversation to have. But main takeaway is just to open the door to back and forth communication about how the data is going to be used so that you can better isolate what specifically they need from the data.
Typically, during data exchanges, one party is the one who decides the EDD format. It may be established by a regulatory agency, or it may be a convention that's associated with a particular EDMS and whatnot. And in those cases, so there's an established format, and the other party typically needs to handle that EDD format, reformat it as necessary, maybe to get it into their own EDMS. But again, to reiterate, as I said before, when there's two parties involved, there is the opportunity for some negotiation on formats or some communication to make it easier, perhaps, on the party that isn't the one who specifies that. The type of data this exchange also matters a lot, because analytical data tends to have a number of more well-defined formats than other types of data. If you're dealing with biological data, toxicity test data, species abundance data, then it's more of a Wild West. There are fewer well-established data formats out there. And if you have a well-established sort of data management practice of data managers, they probably have some experience using a variety of different formats. So they're often maybe a good resource to go to identify an appropriate exchange format when it hasn't been explicitly specified.
On the same topic of kind of outgoing data, we've got a couple of questions coming in. And I was thinking, you know, it sounds like, and especially Tori brought up the idea that a lot of times it's the data use and how that data is being reported. And like Dreas, you say, what types of data, and, you know, kind of how that's being reported. So there's a question of, just like there's standard methods for laboratory methods, analytical methods, are there any standard methods for data reporting that you've heard of or that we discuss in the guidance?
I'll take a stab at it, Olga. Sure. So if we think about sort of, I'm going to use the term reporting formats or layouts. Let's talk about layouts. So as Evan mentioned earlier, you can have a data set that is very flat. So it's just rows and columns. And then you can have, sometimes you hear called pivot tables or crosstab tables, where you have rows and columns corresponding to points of interest, and then you have the pivoted data in the middle that you can use for that purpose. You know, there are other types of reporting that are more visual. So you can do things like time series charts, pie charts showing distribution of analytes over time. Methodology, it's really about what the data is trying to show or illustrate. And if, again, those layouts can also include things like, how do you indicate if a particular data point is in or out of compliance? You know, do you make it bold? Do you make it italic? Do you make it, you know, any number of colors? You know, and it's sort of like, what is the purpose of that data, and what's the best mechanism to report it?
And let me say that if the question about reporting methods includes reporting formats, so the question might be interpreted as, are there standard reporting formats? Well, the short answer is no. Or the short answer is, yes, there are many. The white paper on EDM systems has a little bit of discussion about schemas. So we'll come back to that question about schemas that Olga asked. Schemas also can be interpreted as the structure of your database. What are the tables? What are the relationships in your database? And databases differ. And consequently, appropriate, or let's say optimal, reporting formats for different EDM systems can also differ. So when and if ever there becomes a more or less standard common EDMS structure for environmental data, then we may get to a common reporting format for environmental data. But we're really not there yet.
Yeah, I would concur, Dreas. And I would also say that you get specific reporting structure requirements from certain clients, right? And so they would say, we need to have this in a standardized format that we've been getting. Or from an agency, like a regulatory agency would say, if you're submitting data to us, it needs to be in this format. And so it's not so much standard across the industry as it may be standardized across particular agencies or clients. And I did want to bring up, there's that question in the Q&A pod about New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection is starting to require historical data summarized to try and help with this MW1 problem, which is really exciting. And so the question is, and I want to pitch this to Michael and Chris, actually, who's on the line but hasn't been active yet. Whether either of you have heard through your respective agencies that this is coming up as a concern within the agencies to report historical data.
Yeah, thanks, Olga. I think this is a nice kind of break in here where we can look at this from two different perspectives. If you're summarizing the historical data as part of a report, so if you're doing a five-year review for an NPL listed Superfund site, or if a new company is coming on board and wants to have everything together in one table for quick reviews to show the efficacy of a remediation system or show the extent and magnitude of the work they've done for sampling, that is something that is not uncommon to provide that background summary. If we're looking at it through the lens of a data exchange, like we're talking about here, that delves a lot more into, you know, what is the agency truly looking for? What EDMS is New Jersey DEP using for that data? Do they want to check and see what you have to bring that data and see if there's information missing? Do they want to do a small data migration, taking the data that you have as a company into your database? What is kind of the end goal of it? It's worth evaluating to see. Not all data exchanges are built equally or need that full link. You know, we talked about that earlier. Dreas and Dan mentioned one of the previous questions about skipping some of the hard stuff when you're doing these data migrations, and Evan may have touched on it as well. So that's kind of that perspective that you have to bring here. Summary tables with one kind of long, 11 by 17 printed off document that lists every sample that's ever been taken are one thing for bringing folks up to speed on a site, which is more of like a quick summary versus a full, full data transfer, data migration work. Speaking as a regulatory agency, we don't pivot towards those things as much, but we have been doing a significant number of requests for people to submit historic data in an EDD format specified by the agency to help build this up to make a comprehensive data set that's not just one long flat file table, but rather a series of connected, relational databases with all the QAQC data associated with it.
Thanks, Michael. Chris, was there anything that you wanted to add from the Washington side? Have you heard anything about the historical data requirement or anything coming through in Washington?
No, we haven't heard anything about that. So that's of great interest. We provide data in a relatively flat format as far as result data already. So you can link it really fairly easily. So yeah, I'll be interested in seeing what becomes of that.
Thanks. Yeah, and I don't know if everybody saw in the Q&A pod, but there were a couple comments about how, it's a good practice or would be a good practice to, if you're taking over management of a site, to try and get the historical data and familiarize yourself with that so that you don't perpetuate these problems moving forward. So you know what the existing data is and what those existing locations are called and named. And that, you know, some of the standardization that we talked about where there really isn't standardization across platforms is because there are so many platforms, there are so many EDMSs, they can be customized and worked, and, you know, individually. And I think it's something that is worth saying, and I think we'll talk about as well, is that this is not a commodity type of work. These are really individualized and unique situations in every case, and it is difficult to standardize across this whole industry. So with that in mind, I want to bring up...
I just wanted to jump in and say, I absolutely 100% agree with all that. And I wanted to add that the complexity of all these schemas and all these data formats and all these different options of how to communicate environmental data, it's a reflection of the complexity of environmental data. And the environment's just complicated. There's lots of stuff going on, and it's hard to reflect that in something that's, you know, just some rows and columns kind of thing. So we end up adding these extra layers of complexity to the process in order to better communicate what's actually happening out there in the real world. And that's just hard to do, which is why this process might seem complicated, but we're doing it for a good reason.
Yeah, I'd just like to sort of second that. The complexity arises from things like subsampling, repeated sampling, compositing, replication in the field in the laboratory. There's a lot more structure to environmental data than you kind of think of when you say, oh, go to this spot, take a sample. Well, sometimes it's that simple, and you can get away with a simple EDMS or a spreadsheet, and sometimes it's not that simple. And a lot of different EDMSs that are out there try to strike a balance between the complexity of the inherent environmental data and the simplicity that users really prefer to see the data. So that's part of the reason why there are lots of different solutions.
Yeah, on the same vein, we have a question in the pod that says, for those of us that are seeking to set up an EDMS, you know, and working with kind of a smaller budget and all this sort of stuff, are there any suggestions on particular software? And I just wanted to bring it up that ITRC does not endorse any particular software or names or any particular thing like that. And so it's going to be hard for us to answer that question, but we can at least give you some guidelines and goalposts around what you might be looking for to help. And there is that EDMS fact sheet in the guidance that might be a good place to start to answer that question. Did any of the panelists also want to?
Yeah, I'll mention it. You can look up things like relational database. That will be a start, and then maybe go from there. You can also look up general purpose programming languages, and you can use those resources that you find to automate parts of this process and to make it to function similarly. You'll end up needing to essentially exchange money for experience. Even though you don't spend cash, you'll still need to, you know, learn how it works, and that takes time, and that can also be difficult in its own way.
Thanks, yeah. Evan.
I would say the essential requirement is not specific software, but specific skills, meaning personnel.
Yeah. And I really want to echo Olga's comment about the Environmental Data Management Systems white paper that's associated with the ITRC document here. There's an entire section, section 4, that talks about types of data systems that, again, we can't recommend specific product names, but really outlines what you're looking for based upon your data type and based upon what sort of complexity you're associated with it. The table 2 that's in that fact sheet is a great starting place for it, where it talks about the different types of these systems. And that's a nice first cut approach to see where you're looking. Are you looking at paper files or spreadsheets or a personal database software or an enterprise or multi-user database or a commercial off-the-shelf software or a software as a service? That table in particular is pretty robust and talks about a lot of the considerations that you need to look at or that you would want to look at, and even brought up in your question there, you know, what sort of financial costs are you willing to spend? What sort of complexity of data are you looking at? So I really want to not to punt the question away, but to direct your focus to that white paper as part of the document, which should help you get a nice start on this question.
And Olga, I'll just chime in and say I agree with Michael, Andreas, and others about the skill set needed. The other thing to consider is for those, if you want to consider a commercial solution, you can approach those companies if you're operating in a nonprofit, NGO type of thing, citizen science. I would say, generally speaking, in the industry, there is a little bit of a move toward trying to support those organizations. So again, doesn't hurt to ask, and see if some sort of arrangement can be made.
Great. So let's get back a little bit to kind of the real guts of data exchange again, and just come up with this idea. I think a lot of people are interested in this idea about historical data and data migrations. And so we've talked a lot about the ins and outs of when you can coordinate this ahead of time and you have interested parties that want to share data and like that. But what about this situation where you just received or found a whole bunch of historical data, kind of getting at the point about like, how do you know all these historical well names and how do you get with all this? So you've got a big pile of data. What questions should you be asking before you decide to migrate that into an EDMS? We'll start with Dreas.
So the first kinds of questions you should be asking are, what are the costs? What are the benefits? There are trade-offs, and these trade-offs can be particularly acute with historical data where there are different kinds of formats. Some of them may be EDDs, but they're EDDs you've never seen before, or just tables from documents and so forth. So decisions have to be made about what's the value of these data versus what's the cost going to be to pull them in. And again, looking at the DQOs will help you, or the project DQOs will help you establish what the benefits might be. To help navigate those trade-offs, you really need to pull in all of the interested parties. You need to collaborate with the data users to help you understand where the value is, where the benefit is of those data. So the project managers, for example, may provide good judgments about value, and data managers can probably provide good judgments about potential costs.
Yeah, thanks, Dreas. Speaking of someone who wears a lot of different hats at my particular agency, both as a data manager and a subject matter expert and hydrogeologist and all sorts of other things, leaving the decision of your data migration to your data managers won't necessarily get you what you need. They may not know all aspects of the data and what's truly important and what's not important associated with this. The classic example is someone's migrated all of the analytical data over for something, but they only took the raw results or the results themselves and skipped all the quality assurance, quality control data in the samples, which, seems on the surface, speaking back to that question earlier about the summary tables, like it's a great idea, but you're missing that key metadata, that key information that moves it from numbers on a page to analytical data that can be used to support regulatory decisions or to make health-based decisions for folks in the environment out there. Having to consult your subject matter experts and other end users of the data is a key part of this that oftentimes goes overlooked.
I just want to add a little bit more about the cost of a migration. Generally, the more complicated the migration is, the more costly it will be. And it's determined by both the amount of data that you have, as well as the complexity of the data that you're migrating, and also the available tools and technology and skills that you have at your fingertips. So for example, you might be able to really quickly automatically migrate a large amount of very, very simple data. Maybe you have 100 comma-separated value files that they all follow the same format, they all have the same schema, and they have very consistent valid values. Very easy. It might take just a few minutes to hours to migrate that data. However, on the other hand, a really small amount of really complicated data might take a relatively long time because you can only migrate it manually. It's just not possible to automate that portion because the data is so complex. Now, for example, maybe you have 10 pages of handwritten field notes that you need to migrate into a spreadsheet. You can't necessarily automate that process of reading someone's handwriting and then turning that into the right characters and the right cell on a spreadsheet. It's really, really hard to do.
Another important factor is that migrating the data from one data management system to another won't do anything to change the accuracy of your data. So if you're basically taking, a data set that has been really well used, lots of eyes on it, you're pretty sure that you can just kind of map it to your new EDMS. And at that point, you're not going to have to go back, check old reports, check old lab reports. kind of take it from the path of when it was first reported to the lab to what professional judgments might have been made based on lab QA/QC results, where you might have, you know, decided an acetone detection wasn't meaningful because there was acetone at a really high level in a blank. So that will be a lot easier than if for some reason all of a sudden you're maybe trying to trace back old site COCs that haven't been documented in your report tables to this point. You need to upload paper copies. To Evan's point, that's obviously going to be a lot of manual labor, but then it will also add this extra component that isn't technically migration, but can still substantially increase the cost of the effort.
Tori, can you define COC for people?
Constituent of concern.
Thanks. I was thinking you meant chains of custody.
Very confusing.
So ultimately, like Tori said, you know, the value of your data to you or to the stakeholders is determined by the usefulness in trying to solve a problem, and then the quality of that data in terms of defensibility. But if you don't know what the data quality is of your historical data, or you can't figure out what it is, then you might want to conduct a data audit of that historical data set or data set in order to be able to figure out what exactly you got and what it might cost.
Yeah, and with all those various considerations, let's just say that you've decided you're going to go ahead with the data migration, and it is going to be valuable, and you're going to put all this historical data, or you're going to put a subset of it, or you're going to work on figuring out that. So where do you start? It seems like this monumental task, right, of all the things that we've just talked about, and dealing with quality and dealing with all this wrangling of data into some format. So yeah, where do you start? What's your point? Step one.
So like I'll take a stab at this, Olga. So like I said, the best place to start is conduct an audit of the data to be migrated and develop your strategy. You know, do you do the easy stuff first? Do you do the stuff that's most important from a, you know, sort of regulatory urgency first? You know, you want to consider, do you consider doing things like doing most more recent data first and work your way backwards, or separate it by media? You know, there may be that there's an urgency associated with water samples versus soil samples, for example. And that also can come into play as Evan mentioned earlier, is like, what's the format? If the formats are all over the place, then you may have to consider another value versus something where, as Evan said, you've got 100 comma separated value files. That data may be easy from a automation standpoint in order to be able to get it in. And again, taking into account the item that Tori mentioned about you're making a fundamental assumption about the quality of that data, or you've evaluated it and said, I'm going to migrate it and I'm going to clean it later. And I'm sorry, Evan, one last thing. I'm sorry. There's a data audit white paper in our guidance that also provides some additional information for this startup.
Yeah, that was important to add. Thank you. So my approach is generally to use your data audit to define a series of steps to go from your current format, maybe a crosstab format, maybe a PDF, maybe some flat file or comma separated value text file, that kind of thing. Go from your current format into some other intermediate standardized format, something that you know and love and can you know what's going to happen in there. For example, maybe you transform everything into a flat file with standardized column names that then your EDMS would be able to read. You can then transform it into your final resting place, into the final format of maybe an EDB, and you document the process along the way, all the steps that you took, what you changed, what you did, so that if you need to do it again, or if someone needs to see what happened to the data, you have some record to go back to. And one really nice thing about various tools like automation is that if you program these series of steps, you end up getting both the process of transformation as well as the documentation all in the same spot. There's no difference between the notes of what you did and what you actually did. Those are tied together in automation. And then last but not least, I'll mention that you should also do a quality control check with your final product before you load it into your EDMS, just to make sure there wasn't a mistake along the way.
Evan, can you define flat file for us?
Yes, so a flat file is usually, maybe a spreadsheet would be most familiar. It's usually two-dimensional, so you have columns and you have rows. Comma-separated value files fall into that category as well, because all of the columns are separated by commas. It's a type of file where that's in two dimensions rather than more dimensions or something else like that.
So during the data migration process, we've talked a little bit about data quality. And data migration and data quality are two separate issues or topics, but they are related, because sometimes in migration, you choose not to get all the data. You can't get all the data. So that's a completeness issue, potentially a data quality issue. We do have a white paper as part of the environmental data management products, and that data quality white paper goes into different dimensions of data quality in more detail. That topic will also be addressed in the upcoming roundtable on May 2nd. It's important throughout the processes of migration and data quality assessment or resolution to integrate the data managers into the rest of the project staff to make sure that they are fully informed about the project goals, the DQOs. The responsibilities for data quality as well as data migration really should be shared among multiple project staff. It's easy to say, oh, this data is a problem, data manager, go fix it. But it's really the responsibility of the entire project staff to make sure the right thing is being done and in the right way.
Great. I see we've got a comment, a question in the chat here about, for historical data migration, when we're concerned with the data quality, how do we handle specifically J flags and understanding why the J flag might exist? Would it be typical for EDDs to include the explanations as well as the flagging? And where would you put that explanation if so? Michael, you want to take this?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great question and something that I think all of us struggle with on a consistent basis. QA/QC can be, you know, part science, part art at some points, because there are all of these different factors that you have to consider. You know, was this data flagged because it was out of temp? Well, was it collected from a well that was 2 minutes outside the lab and it was stored on ice? So therefore, even though it's not, you know, at the temp it needs to be, it was met all the requirements, just hasn't had a chance to cool down. JFLAG data in particular is difficult, as some labs don't provide it, and some have different, you know, definitions for what they even consider to be a limit of quantitation or a sample specific detection limit as part of the labs. To throw back to one of my earlier answers on this, the usage of these translation tables or these other sort of reference tables is really helpful on it. If you can get the lab in particular as part of your data migration to have a listing of it, you know, in most cases, the EDD from a lab as part of the historical data migration isn't the legal copy, the PDF copy is, and those should have a listing of the quality assurances that have been applied to the data and the flags that may be associated with it. That can provide that additional data about what a JFLAG meant in this particular information, or in this particular situation, excuse me. So those can be cases where a translation table is really helpful. A lot of times there are open remark fields in an EDD that can allow you to put some information in there and to go through and do that. But as we all know, it's extremely difficult to sanitize open text fields. And people like me who are really long-winded have problems fitting things into 256 characters occasionally. So working with the labs, having these translation tables as part of your reference values or providing some small feedback can really help you and figuring out what's going on with that and why the JFLAG data is what it is for this particular case, which varies lab by lab and may vary through a time, especially in historic cases.
Let me just add, I work with a couple of systems where that incorporated what were called reason codes. And those were one or two letter codes that represented the reasons, say, for a JFLAG or even an R or a U flag sometimes. And they were generally related to different types of laboratory QC measurements. So if the blanks were out of control, if there was, you know, contamination or the RPD of duplicates were out, those conditions would each get a different type of reason code. And those in the systems I've seen that do this way, those are stored in separate columns of the data table next to the qualifiers. But that's rare. That's not a common way of handling the process.
If I could just add on to what Drea said, that's a good point to consider when we were on the topic we were talking about earlier about that specification for the EDD and the format for your system, is that the reason codes that Drea referenced, that's a valid value. And those need to be communicated to both your stakeholders and to, you know, the laboratories that are providing that data to you. So you have that common vocabulary, so you don't end up with reason codes that are all over the place, or there's multiple versions of the same thing, because then it can be confusing.
Yeah, along that same lines, we've got a question that came in about, so, you know, when we're talking about legacy and historical data and we're talking about migrations, what, it just disappeared. It's coming back, sorry. The important pieces can be missing. Like, you might not actually have that quality data associated with that. I'm wondering, Tori, do you maybe want to take this associated with kind of that audit that we had gone through in the first discussion about this?
Sure. I guess if you definitely don't give anyone more confidence in your data than there should be, I think both on the audit end, I don't know if we'll get to this question, but we did have some questions kind of talking about, like, as we're moving even further into the migration process, how to document it, track it, QC it. And I think that would be another very important place, is figure out the best way to store the information so that it can go into your system, because I realize a duplicate where you don't know the primary sample is going to probably involve a creative workaround to import in most systems. But if you want to import it, do that and do it in a way where both whatever you develop makes it clear that the parent isn't available. And then a very important part of the migration process is clear. You know, as Evan mentioned, that's a huge appeal of automation, is that you have that very clear documentation. But if you, for some reason, can't automate it, staff skill set might be a limitation. Make sure somewhere, somehow, that doesn't get lost over time, there is a documentation to what was migrated, what the limitations of it were, especially from a quality perspective, and how that may have been, you know, handled as you imported it.
Can you just define parent in your description so that we know what you're talking about?
Parent would be the primary sample. So if you have a field duplicate from boring one, soil boring one, it would be like, oh, we collected that sample and then we took a field duplicate of it. But for some reason, if it's from 1987, you only have the duplicate and don't know what the results were for the original sample. That would be the parent sample.
Thanks.
Olga, if I could just add on to what Tori said, one thing that you may find yourself is, whatever EDMS system you use, you may have some schema requirements that require certain fields where you don't have the data. And in which case, as Tori said, you may need to put that in and document it, that you've made an assumption. You've documented the assumption, it's reflected in the database, and that way you can, it's defensible as a, you know, whether it's common sense or, you know, institutional knowledge or what have you, that you said, this is what this is when we did this for the purposes of migration, in order to be able to get the data in. Again, it may be just a schema requirement that you have to comply with.
Great. Thanks so much for all that. I did also, there's still a question in the Q&A pod too about sort of that project team that Dreas was talking about, and the staffing and kind of the literacy around using data and exchanging data. And what are some of these kind of strategies around making sure that the right people have access and are knowledgeable and have the ability to kind of do this type of a thing? I do just want to give a plug that a lot of this stuff is talked about in our data governance. That's kind of associated with the data governance fact sheet and parts of our guidance. But I think there is an important aspect of data exchange, because we've hit on it multiple times here today, that you do have to have the right people who both know the data and know the processing of the data, can manage it and also know the uses of it, that it's worth discussing a little bit. So did anybody on the panel want to take this one to start? Michael.
Yeah, no problem. I saw Evan unmute as well, so I was going to give him a chance to speak. But this is a great reason to do a data migration, to do a data exchange, to facilitate the data exchange, to make sure that the data and the quality is needed by each individual who needs that level of data literacy or that level of detail for it. If you're a quality assurance manager, you may need the chromatographs, you may need to do a level 4 data validation on it, and having the right people part of that to make sure that that data is transmitted to you in a way that you can work with it is great. Putting another plug for our historical data migration fact sheet on there, one of our big selling points as part of that we spent so much time in Minnesota to migrate our historic data from, you know, our kind of slogan was data from paper files into a database where we can work with it, is it's really improved our ability to make data accessible to staff who are not technical or to the public in general. So as part of the data migration work, we were able to accompany and have a huge swath of data users have access to the data in the way that makes sense to them. My average PM or our hydrologist on the site may not need to look at every little bit of quality control data, but my QA coordinator does. Because we've done the data migration to include that entire scope, we can create those derived work products off of the final authoritative data source stored in our environmental database management system and share it out there. It really makes it easy and comprehensive and a nice way to make the data accessible for all in the level that makes best sense for them.
Yeah, I'll add on and say it's all about communication. And what you don't want to have is like separate silos of like, okay, these are the people who like know what this data means, and these are the people who are completely different who know how to process it. You don't want to have two separate groups of individuals with no overlap in the Venn diagram. I think it's all about having those overlaps, having some communication among those teams and among those people. You do still want to retain some separation of responsibility. You don't need that much redundancy to do every single little thing for your environmental database management system. But having at least a little bit of overlap is important. And you can help to grow that in your culture, in your community, by encouraging more communication. So for example, if you have someone who, let's say they automate some part of the process in a way, that they can try to explain how that works, or at least how some part of that works, to someone else on the team who might not know how that works yet. And then vice versa, if someone knows why the data are the way they are, why do you take duplicates? They can help to explain that to the data processing team. So that communication, that overlap is how you can help to democratize the literacy.
Yeah, and if I can just say another word to put those things together, at least from my perspective, communication is key, but to elaborate a little bit, or maybe summarize, Michael's point, data literacy means different things to different people. So to a project manager, to a laboratory data validator, to a data manager, they have different views of the data. They need to know different things. And they also need to recognize that other parts of the team need to know different things, need to know different information, and they need to be able to communicate with each other about those differences.
Great. There's another question that came in that's kind of similar about that, about are there suggestions on how do we kind of make this type of information, like Evan, you were talking about, in the processing of the data, in the managing and the storing of the data, to sort of future others to deal with that type of decision-making? Like, how is a good way to document that? Is it, where is it, and how is that?
Yeah, I'll try and start with that one. Whatever communication makes sense, whatever documentation makes sense for your team. If it makes sense to you, then hopefully it makes sense to the next person, and so on and so forth. And you can always improve it over time, but at least having something to start with is the important part. As far as suggestions for storing, relating, and making it available, I usually go for something like you can use literate programming is a term that you might want to look up. Where you essentially have your automation, your code is also literate, it's understandable, you can read it almost. So it makes it much easier to read and easier to access for yourself and for others in the future. There's a variety of ways to document the decisions that you make along the way as well, either in a spreadsheet or in a text file or in a big book. You can document it in the code itself. You can document in like a repository itself. There's many different levels and layers where you can add documentation. And in my opinion, the more the better. Try and have a little bit available at all points in time. And it is also something that you need to update. It's not just a one-time and done kind of thing. You should review it over time and make sure it's still accurate and make sure someone's responsible for updating it and keeping it accurate.
If I could just add on to what Evan said, I mean, really, ultimately, it's about the data governance at your particular organization. You know, if there are standards at that organization, or maybe there need to be standards. You know, again, as Olga mentioned earlier, we have a fact sheet and a section of the guidance documents to talk about data governance. And this is a hot topic, I would say, at the moment. So this is certainly something to consider. And that's going to certainly help you with some of those logistical or administrative things. Where is it? How is it maintained? How is it changed? In those types of circumstances.
I know Michael will probably back me up when I say, oftentimes we need to think about these types of big migration projects as projects themselves. And so when you think about how you document another environmental project, like say your project is based on doing some drilling and some water sampling or whatever, you would normally be writing a work plan and you would normally then be writing a report to document how you were going to do something and then how you did something. And it is kind of important to think about these. We tend to think of, you know, the data world as just a part of this bigger piece, but the data has its own needs and has its own project relevance, right? And so what we talk about in a lot of the other fact sheets in the guidance that aren't focused on data exchange, but are focused on data planning is making a data plan, is to actually write a data management plan. And we talk about the processes and dictate all that sort of stuff there. And that's what, like Dan's saying, is in governance, is when you think about governance, you need to think about it as a holistic picture of how all of this data work is being done as a project into itself. And I think the literacy comes from having those conversations with all these people that are involved with data to let them know that it's not just a side piece. It is an integrated process in the project that you likely need to have a work plan appendix as a data plan to make that all part of this all work, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree wholeheartedly with that. At a really, really high level, this needs to be documented in one way, shape, or form. People don't like writing documentation for it, but if it's comments, metadata, a work plan, a data management plan, a data governance plan, data in and of itself can mean different things. You know, you have an EDD submitted to someone and you put four technical staff in the room for an hour, you come back later and there's eight different opinions on what that data means. And having that diagnosis and the written information around it can help put that in perspective, not only from, you know, what it means or what was done to it, but, you know, where does this fit into the grand scheme of the project? And making sure it's an integrated part of the project, as Olga mentioned, is a really important thing. And that's kind of a paradigm shift to get these integrated teams and to make data a key portion of the work, not an afterthought.
You know, I'll add that our catchphrase for a lot of this this roundtable, this whole process at RTRC has been that data are an asset. Like your data are literally an asset. They are extremely valuable. And it's not just a saying, it's also like they are an intangible asset for your company. Like this is something that you can use. And like if you're a company, you can benefit from. If you're a state agency, it's something that the people of your state, they own it. Like that is theirs. And what's more valuable, a pile of papers that, you know, are very disorganized, or a nice neat computer database somewhere that's easy to access and use? And that's the value. That's the asset that we're building here and trying to maintain here. Just like, you know, if you own a house, you can't just leave it in disrepair. You still need to take care of it. If you're going to give it to somebody else to take care of, you need to document and record like all the little intricacies of what happens there. It's something that you own. It's an asset and it's important.
So we have another question that came in the Q&A pod. Thanks so much for all of your questions. And this is really great to just answer exactly what you guys are interested in and what you want to hear. So this one is about compiling a lot of different historical data that's very different. Are there advantages or disadvantages to putting everything into one big schema in a master set, or to keep things siloed and segregated? Andreas, do you want to start?
Sure. So I would say ideally, sure. If you can put it all into one system and you have a system that's built to accommodate and you have the skills necessary to model it and integrate it, that's good. That's one place where everybody can go to get it. But those constraints may not always be met. And sometimes the data are just so different that it hardly matters. If you have a lot of sediment chemistry data and you have a lot of seabird observations data, and nobody is ever going to look at those data together, then there's not really much benefit to putting them into the same system. But if you have a lot of sediment chemistry data and a lot of water chemistry data, it's quite likely that somebody's going to want to look at those together. So you need to bear in mind several different factors, one of which is sort of the data models, but also the data uses to make your decision about whether those things should go together or not. And then you have to factor in, again, you know, whether you have or can build a data model that links them and whether you have or can get the expertise to do that work.
Yeah, I'll add that I also agree that, I think that having one database would be good if it does make sense. And you'd be surprised. I mean, everything's environmental. It probably has a location associated with it. And if they're using the same location, then yeah, why not have them in the same database? If it is too much work to bring them all together, if you already have separate databases and it doesn't necessarily make sense to pull them together, then you can have them separate. But if you can, I think you should.
It sounds like a lot of the questions and kind of our discussion around data migration are wrapping up a little bit, but I do think that there's maybe one last thing that we should talk about, and that's when we're in this type of scenario, when does it make sense to automate migration, and when do we think that the manual approach is preferable? And Evan, do you want to start?
Yeah, so automation, just to give you guys a common definition, is your computer following a set of instructions that you provide, and it was usually code, programs. This code is both the recipe for your computer to follow, as well as the documentation of what actually happened during the migration. It's the recipe is the same thing as the process. It's great. It's lovely because there's no difference between the instructions you want to follow and the instructions you actually followed. There's some great benefits to automation, such as cost savings over time. Transparency, reproducibility, and documentation. So you can see exactly what you did. It's not, evaporate into thin air after you're done. It's transparent. It's reproducible. You can do it again if you need to or with slightly modified data. It's documented, so you can actually read through what happened and make decisions based on whether or not that was good or bad. And it also can help save you some money. Usually if you invest up front, it saves you some time later on down the line. And that can be really nice. However, that's all great. Only benefits, but there are costs as well. It does take some time to do. If you have to, finish your data migration today, you might not want to spend 2 days automating it. But it might be worth it if you have a longer time frame. I also think it's kind of like a dishwasher. It just does its thing. It cleans everything inside it in the same exact way. Some things that make sense to put in a dishwasher, you might put your plates and your bowls in, although they're really common, the common utensils and whatnot, but don't put your nice knife in there. Don't put something that you really like need to hand wash in there. And in terms of data, what that means is that if you have really common, consistent, standardized formats, those can absolutely be automated. But if you have something unique or specialized or like one thing that something's going to happen only once, you might not want to automate that. You might want to do that manually.
Building on what Evan said, obviously when it works out, you have the right type of data and the right skill set, et cetera, like automation generally is going to win. But this is kind of a point where it's good to go back to that inventory and compartmentalization that we discussed in some of our earlier responses, in that, if you start with a plan because you did your inventory, you kind of know what data sets are consistent, might make sense to automate, what might be one or two random PDFs that might make more sense to type. Another important factor to consider is your staffing and your skills. As we kind of highlighted, there's different skill sets that overlap throughout our project teams and then even within our data teams. So it might be good to kind of say, okay, we have this many people who can automate and this many tasks that could be automated, and then pick the ones that are highest priority to use those skill sets so that you don't have like a scheduling bottleneck or just burn any one person out, and then kind of build down from there to what might, maybe, you know, you needed a custom script for some of it. Maybe you can use a low code, no code solution for a different portion and kind of delegate that, assign it to keep it moving. And then there may still, again, the small PDFs, a highly detailed oriented person with good notes. Similarly on the QC end, once you finish the migration, there's a lot of automated checks. And we do discuss both the benefits of automated versus manual migration in the document and some kind of QC checks to run. And those you can do some scripted, but then it's also can be good to have somebody involved to just do some basic look at your original set and look at your new one to make sure that nothing fell through from just like a professional judgment perspective.
Yeah, let me just add another advantage of automation is the script itself can be QA, and it's much more cost effective to QA a script that you're going to be using over and over again than to QA every single data import or data exchange.
I think another thing I just wanted to mention, since it seems appropriate for this topic, that we saw in the Q&A pod is was a question asking about AI and the role that it has in the future of EDMS. I'm sure Evan has thoughts on this too. My experience so far is this is a very hot field, and it's very timely because, as Evan pointed out, this is one thing where this automation, you're looking for pattern recognition and, you know, where it can really streamline the processing of data. It does not replace, hopefully not yet, the need for folks with institutional knowledge or, you know, professional judgment on the data. So I think I think my fellow panelists would probably agree this is an interesting topic, and one I'm certainly following to see where it takes us. Hopefully it won't put me out of a job, but you never know, maybe I can retire early.
Just hope for more PDFs, Dan, more PDFs.
Yeah, I would love if there was an AI that I could like throw a PDF in and say, hey, please turn this into an EDD. That would, oh my goodness, that would be, yes, please. Please tell me. I will give you so much money, I promise. But it's hard to do, and it's hard. I don't think if there is one, that'd be lovely. But a lot of EDMS, a lot of data management, data migration is about responsibility and who did what to the data. And is it right or is it wrong? Is it accurate or is it not? Does it actually reflect what you measured, what you sampled? Now, what's the quality of it? And that responsibility, it has to go onto a person at some point, or an organization, a group of people. And you can't put that level of responsibility onto an AI without having at least some oversight by a human, by a person to take the final call on that. But it's like a tool. It's any tool. If you can use it and it's useful, then yeah, great. If you use it and it's not useful, then ooh. Programming is a tool as well. And you put some responsibility on the coders and on the people to QA it at the end. I could see you doing the same thing with AI. If it gets you doing the job a little bit better and faster, that'd be great. It's like any other tool, as long as it's useful.
One thought that's jumping to my mind on that is, I know we keep talking about, oh, if you have old field notes, they're only in paper. They're kind of hard to, you know, we mentioned writing scripts over a well-OCR'd PDF. You can code your way to an EDD. Is, you know, developments in that area like better trends? Because I don't know if anyone else has had this problem, but I've definitely had the dream of, oh, well, we have the script to take the lab report, put in a nice EDD if we don't have any other resources, and the handwriting recognition just isn't there yet.
Yeah, I'll add that when you, if you for AI, I guess I won't specify which AI, but if you have a large language model, for example, and you need to type in exactly, you need to tell it what process, what kind of code you want it to make for you, the process of specifying exactly what you want into a large language model is essentially just coding. It's just, a human readable version of coding. And most code is already kind of human readable. So I'm not sure how much additional benefit you can get from especially when you have really specific needs, there's only one right way to do something. I'm not sure if a large language model or other AI could get better than just programming, because that is what programming is. It's specifying a set of instructions to a computer, and it already has layers of abstraction to it that make it pretty relatively easy, relatively simple, relatively easy to read.
Great. Well, let's jump back a little bit to some more details on schema and valid values and EDDs, that we've got some more questions. So one of them is it typically considered a best practice to get your EDD directly from a lab, or is it generally okay for an agency to receive them by an RP or a consultant or a contractor? And Michael, do you want to take that?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, which is the agency I work for, we request that we get the EDs directly from the analytical laboratories. There are some cases, you know, historical data or cases where they're utilizing a third-party data validation firm, where that EDD may be routed through a responsible party or a consultant or another case there. But it's generally best to get it directly from the analytical laboratories for a couple of different reasons. One touches what I talked about earlier about the legal copy of record for it. The more people you have in your chain of custody, either documented or not documented, the more chances there are for things to be changed, or it may not be documented fully. You may not have an ECOC format ready to go, so you're just assuming that everything is as submitted to the lab, or there's been changes there. Touching on something else we talked about earlier about the importance of documentation. If it's coming from the consultant or the RP, you may not have any documentation of the changes that occurred associated with it. And the final one is, just for the opportunity to work with your analytical laboratories that submit data to your regulatory agency, to be able to look back. And there was a question earlier in the chat about a question from someone who had noted that despite the fact that there was a stormwater matrix, that they kept reporting the data as groundwater. If you've got that intermediate party on that, and that's correcting the mistakes for you, you lose the opportunity to work with your lab to get data directly correctable from the source. And even that consultant or the RP may be the ones paying the dollars for that analysis, but coming from your regulatory agency, you can hold a little bit more weight occasionally on that. Sometimes it happens where you do have to get them from a consultant or a regulated party, but generally it's best to get them directly from the lab if possible.
Yeah, Chris, I know behind the scenes there, I'm interested in your perspective again from Washington and sort of what you think from an agency perspective on whether you want to get that directly from the laboratory.
We've discussed it. California requires it. But we don't. We route it through the consultants. It seems like it's worked okay. In California, it took legislation to require that, so we haven't wanted to go that route. But so far, it's working okay. Coming through consultants, even through our own lab, we don't directly input data. It gets looked at first by the experts before it goes into the system. So we don't require that. I'm interested to know if other states do besides Minnesota and California.
Be a good topic for our next EDM committee. Yeah. Okay. So there's also a question about, can we provide any general advice around how to develop schema? And I feel like this is a question that can really go down a lot of rabbit holes here. But let's see, Dreas, is this something that you want to take? No. who would okay, go for it.
Sorry, does somebody else want to pick that up? I was looking at a different question.
I'll take a stab at it, Dreas. Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, if you want to sort of roll your own schema, you have to consider all the data typing that you have across the potential data sources that you want to collect from. Again, I think somebody mentioned the Q&A pod. You develop you can develop a relationship diagram, understand where options are. I do know that there in some, particularly with spatial data, there are some models that leverage environmental data. So if you have GIS practitioners in your organization, you may ask them if they can refer you to a geospatial model that has an environmental component. That's an option, at least to get you started for developing a schema.
So, yep. Oh, go ahead, Dres.
Yeah. So I will jump in here and say that really to develop a schema for some data type that you don't have capability of handling right now requires subject matter expertise. And it also requires somebody with the right sort of analytical mindset to understand how the whole complex smear of data can be broken up into little pieces. And if we think about this EDM ultimately being represented by a relational data model, one of the types of expertise that's necessary is somebody with a good understanding of what a relational model is and how data can be factored to fit into those types of relations. And those two types of skills, the subject matter expertise and the relational modeling skill, are both needed.
Yeah, I'm glad I let you go there, Dreas, because you help build on what I'm going to say. So as Dan and Dreas mentioned on this, and as they talked about, this is a really complex question. There's a lot of things out there, a lot of things to consider, a lot of expertise required. And kind of like we mentioned earlier about valid values, this is a case where you may not necessarily have to reinvent the wheel. You can look towards other systems that may be out there. I think this question was from Eagle, so from a state agency on this. But if you can look towards other state agencies nearby, or you can look at your EPA region, if they've got a data format or a data schema that matches what you're doing, that is going to make life easier for you. Hopefully, fingers crossed, have consulted with the folks who hold those expertise that Dan and Dreas mentioned on it too, and can help make it more consistent and will smooth out some of the bumps that come when you have analytical labs start requiring a new format for things. If it's similar to an existing one, you can leverage that hard work and blood, sweat, and tears that others have put into it. It's always a good idea to survey and see what's out there first before you start from scratch.
Thanks. So there's another question here, and I think that Dreas, this is the one that you wanted. So sorry to mistake that before. How do you handle units reported differently by the lab than if the stakeholder is requiring a different reporting standard? Like how, and mostly it's like the question of how do you handle significant figures in a database, which I know is, it's a real complicated issue as well, or can be if you haven't thought through it.
Right. And the question says, how do you do it? And if the question you is addressed to us as a group, I think you will find, let's see, 6, 7, 8 different answers here. The question is, you can do it. You can do the unit conversion when the data come in. You can do the unit conversion when the data go out. I'll give you my opinion. My opinion is it's better to retain the units in your database management system as they are reported. It's easier to QA. Okay. If you're going to do unit conversion, do them on the way out, because the type of unit conversion may differ depending upon who you are exchanging data with. And as for sig figs can be stored in the database. Along with the column that stores the concentration, you can store another integer value that records a number of significant digits. And it's possible to write code to automatically propagate significant digits if you're doing computations. Not commonly done, but it can be done. So go for it.
I just wanted to jump in and say with significant digits, you can also store them as a text file. We do both in our database. So we retain the text file so we know what the sig digs were, and we can also use the numeric for making calculations.
Yeah, I'll add on and say that generally sig figs, it's a matter of a propagation of uncertainty. So whenever you measure anything, there is some uncertainty with that measurement, and you need to retain the amount of uncertainty with that measurement as long as possible. And sig figs is a way to do that. That's kind of easy with the number of digits and stuff like that. But yeah, like everyone else said, you do want to keep those original units because that will be as good as it gets. You will never, anything else, anytime you convert, will just propagate the uncertainty more and more and more. It never gets as good as it is in the beginning.
So I don't know if you all feel the same way, but I feel like we could talk about data management and data exchange for forever, but we do actually only have 2 minutes left. And so I want to leave us with one last question, and then I'm going to give each panelist only 10 seconds to answer, which is, what do you think is the biggest risk associated with data exchange? We'll start with that.
I'll start.
Yeah.
So I would consider the liability and the integrity in your data. You are the steward of this data. You are responsible for its accuracy. You don't want to get it wrong.
Yep. I'll go next because I think I'm next in order on this. Your data makes real life decisions. The data that you have, the propagation that you have, can impact people's lives. It can impact human health and the environment, and it can impact legal standings on things. So it's not just numbers on a screen. It is a real life situation that can impact human health and the environment.
I'll go. There are some risks associated with different data models. And the one that we see a lot is that one system stores laboratory analytical data with lots of detail all the way down to individual laboratory replicas. Another system only stores it up to a very high aggregated level. And if the same data are in those two different systems, they may look different. And somebody may say, oh, there's a problem. Somebody has aggregated the data, come up with a different number. That can be a potential risk. Simply, it's a misunderstanding, but a risk.
I'd say reiterate an earlier point of just never work in a silo, because data management tends to be all about reducing complexity to simplicity for the sake of, you know, more automated approaches. But as Evan said earlier, the environment is complex. There's only so much simplicity you can bring to it. And I think one of the biggest risks I've seen is the times that somebody's been, you know, blinded by trying to strip some meaningful information off of something to make it fit a preconceived data model, that they actually did, you know, lose sight of something that mattered to a project team.
I think for me, the biggest risk is lack of data governance when you're undertaking data exchange and migration. And how to mitigate it is leverage the fact sheets that have been prepared by the EDM team. Everything from security to data retention to frequency to data dictionaries. The team spent a lot of time working some of these issues out. Leverage those resources, and that will save you from headaches in the future.
Thanks so much, everyone. Thank you all for joining and for your questions and your attention. And I think Devin had said this will be recorded and available later. And you'll get the information through the CLUIN where you registered. And we appreciate all your support. And I hope you enjoy the guidance.